This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello, my name's Harry. I'm a content manager here in L&G's Asset Management Division. Now, as every holidaymaker knows, changes in foreign exchange rates can have a big impact on the cost of a stay abroad. For investors, Forex risk leads to a decision. Either accept the additional volatility that exchange rates can add to a portfolio, or pay to hedge against this risk. Here to share his analytical expertise is John Southall, Head of Strategic Research in our Asset Allocation team, who is publishing a research paper on this topic next month. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Glad you, Harry. Happy to be here.
Before we look at your findings, I'd like to ask why you decided to tackle this subject now. I'm guessing that this must have been a field of inquiry for centuries since the beginning of international trade. What makes this debate particularly relevant today?
So as you say, this debate has been going on for a long time, and it's an important question to think about with several factors that can influence how much to hedge. But one theme we're seeing in general is an increase in interest around much longer term strategic asset allocation. This concerns investors with long, potentially even multi-decade time horizons. And so we thought it appropriate to revisit the question through that lens.
Okay, that makes sense. So starting with the real basics here, what is the objective of Forex hedging? And does this objective suggest that some asset classes may be more suited to being hedged than others?
The key objective of FX hedging is to manage the risk associated with fluctuations in exchange rates. So if you invest in some foreign assets and you don't FX hedge them, part of the return you'll end up with will be due to changes in exchange rates. Now, with some potential exceptions, it's generally considered a good idea to currency hedge global bonds. That almost always reduces risk substantially because currency returns are generally pretty volatile compared with bond returns. However, results are no longer clear-cut when we look at more risky assets like equities. Equity returns are inherently much more volatile than bonds, as is well known. Perhaps less well known is that currency movements often interact with equity returns in complicated ways, rather than remaining independent.
So taking the example of a UK-based investor, how might they choose to hedge currency risk in, let's say, the US dollar or the Swiss franc versus exposures to what we might think of as being riskier currencies? And what's the underlying thinking that goes on here?
This links to the potential lack of independence that I just mentioned. It can make sense to adopt lower FX hedge ratios of equities from relatively safe haven areas. So currencies like the Swiss franc, the Japanese yen, the US dollar, these tend to appreciate during periods of equity market sell-offs. It's not something that's guaranteed to happen by any means, but these currencies do generally appreciate in a downturn, which provides a nice offset. Conversely, it's theoretically optimal to hedge more of currencies from relatively risky regions, as they're more likely to depreciate in a downturn. Now, I use the word theoretically there, not just because I like theory, but because in practice, hedging very risky emerging market currencies is rare due to some complications. One is the higher cost and practical difficulty of doing so. Another is that these currencies are often expected to appreciate in real terms over time for some interesting economic reasons. Now, explaining those economic reasons in detail could result in a much longer podcast, but it's a result of something called the Balassa-Samuelson effect.
Okay. In your research paper, you mentioned that there are a couple of aspects of the debate around currency hedging that are sometimes overlooked. And the first one you mention is considering returns only in nominal terms, something that you call the money illusion. Can you explain the interaction between inflation and FX risk?
It's imperfect, but the key idea is that higher domestic inflation relative to that abroad tends to be associated with a weakening of the home currency. And to the extent that's true, FX exposure can operate as a proxy inflation hedge. Now, it's not going to protect you against global inflation, because global inflation will weaken all currencies, but it can help protect you against relatively high domestic inflation. That's quite an important feature of FX exposure, and any analysis that doesn't make it returns relative to inflation will miss this potential benefit.
The other point you make is that the time horizon matters and that a decision to hedge may be sensible for a short-term investor, but a longer time frame could change things. I know from reading the draft of your paper that there are several different aspects to this, but what's the underlying basic idea here?
The basic idea is that real exchange rates, which just means inflation-adjusted exchange rates, are very noisy in the short run. But in the long run, real exchange rates don't tend to move nearly as much as their short-term fluctuations might suggest. So what does that mean? It essentially means that the noise becomes relatively less important. And that's really thanks to economic fundamentals forming a long-term anchor. If that theory is true, it can promote lower FX hedges over longer time horizons, especially if you consider the costs of hedging.
I'd like to turn now to the meat, if you will, of the research paper, which is based on your analysis of data going back to 1926. What questions did you set out to answer when you undertook that analysis? And what were the results that you found?
The idea really was to see what the data told us and if it was consistent with the theory that I briefly outlined. A researcher called Dr. Fruit, who is a retired professor of Harvard Business School, has done something similar that supports the idea of lower FX hedge ratios in the long term. However, I wanted to include some more recent data as his stopped in 1990. The world's obviously changed since then, and I wanted to see if I could reach similar conclusions. I took a UK-based investor in US equities and used data covering the period from 1926, as you say, to 2024, so almost 100 years, and performed analysis on that. The upshot was that it did give some sensitive support for the idea, especially once costs were allowed for. However, the results weren't quite as clear-cut as for Dr. Fruit's analysis.
I'm really interested in the challenges of using data that stretches back so far, covering a period, obviously, when global markets were very different from today. When you conduct an exercise like that, is there a compromise to be had between the volume of the data and the relevance of that data?
Absolutely. Studying the long-term properties of asset classes and exposures is notoriously difficult, especially if they're volatile. To say anything statistically meaningful, you need an awful lot of data. 100 years sounds like a lot, but if you're interested in 10-year horizons, for example, that 100 years only actually represents 10 independent data points. So that obviously encourages going as far back as possible. But the trouble is, the further you go back, the less markets tend to look like today's markets. And so there's a greater danger of drawing conclusions based on the past that don't necessarily apply to the future. One example of that is that there are periods of fixed exchange rates in the data. For example, under the Bretton Woods system, 1944 to 1971, sterling was pegged to the dollar, which clearly isn't the case now. It's worth noting, however, that this doesn't necessarily invalidate the analysis. It turns out the fact that we get supporting results despite these pegs may actually strengthen the findings.
So having outlined the theoretical backdrop and then looked at the question through a financial analyst lens, the final part of your research paper switches perspective again to give an economist's side of the story. Does economics provide a rationale for the idea that lower hedges can make more sense over longer time horizons?
Yes, and it's worth expanding on that rationale. So there are a few different ways to think about it, but one concept I outline in the paper is the idea of purchasing power parity, bit of a mouthful, often abbreviated to PPP. This says that real exchange rates ought to converge in the long run. That possibly sounds quite abstract, but the basic idea is that the prices of things shouldn't diverge too much when you express them in a common currency. A light-hearted version of this you may have heard of is the Economist magazine's Big Mac Index, which compares Big Mac prices across the world when converted into US dollars. Now, PPP is far from perfect, but intuitively you would expect some reasonable bounds on how cheap or expensive buying a Big Mac on holiday in the US could become. You'd be a bit shocked if it worked out 10 times cheaper or 10 times dearer than at home, for example. If PPP were actually just a weaker condition called relative PPP holds, then FX exposure can work as a partial inflation hedge because it will gain from relatively high domestic inflation. But crucially, it is a long-term theme, and substantial noise can make FX exposure less attractive in the short run. So to sum up, there's reasonably persuasive evidence that relative PPP holds in the long run, and it makes good economic sense as well. But convergence is slow, and short-term deviations, i.e. moves in these real exchange rates, are large and volatile. That's a really key aspect.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today, John. The research paper is absolutely fascinating. If you found our conversation interesting, do keep an eye out for John's forthcoming white paper, which will come out next month and will be available via our blog.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of Legal & General Investment Management Limited, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for information purposes only, and we are not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general economic, market or political issues and/or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not an offer or recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against Legal & General in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this document contains third-party information, the accuracy and completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person resident in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulation. Copyright 2024. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. In Hong Kong, this material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on X, formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.